the drive, draws the contact, count it, and one! Chris Paul putting on a show!
It was a show that kept getting canceled before it ever got to this stage. For a dozen postseasons, actually. We watched Chris Paul, the so-called point god, lose his powers and wander the earth and basically write his own basketball obituary. But last night, in his NBA Finals debut, the league's most demanding superstar reaffirmed his immortality against the Bucks, turning his doubters into heretics. So today, our resident CP3-ologian, Kevin Arnovitz, explains the New Testament of Chris Paul and what prayer Milwaukee has to stop him. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, July 7th. This is ESPN Daily. Kevin Arnovitz, it is 11:40 p.m. Eastern time. We just watched game one of these NBA Finals. And first off, how are you doing, man? You're good?
I'm doing very well.
Kevin Arnovitz has been explaining the intricacies of the NBA to me for more than a decade. Look, you're a basketball connoisseur, Kevin. You're also somebody who knows Chris Paul better than anyone else that I know. And it was really hard for me, because there are other players I want to talk to you about on the Phoenix Suns, but it was really hard for me to watch this game, which the Suns won, 118-105, and not obsess over what we just saw from a 36-year-old CP3 in his very first NBA Finals game ever, because he finished with 32. So what did you see out of him in this game?
I mean, it was vintage CP.
Paul on the drive, layup is good!
He bled them to death. You know, he controlled every offensive possession. He was the planner. He sussed out what the defense was doing, its coverages, where its focus was, where its vulnerabilities were. He knew exactly what was available to the offense teammate by teammate, and he was often the most available. And there's this band of space where he wants to go. We all know where it is. It's like a crescent along from from the elbows of the lane. Like, it's, you know, we say his spot. It's actually multiple spots. And if it's not there, he has this handle and the dexterity to get himself the breathing room to cross you over, step back, drain a jumper. He's a really underrated outside shooter.
Booker to Paul, three-pointer. That's good! Chris Paul pouring it on right now.
I mean, Pablo, I can't recall a player with this unique route to his first NBA Finals, right? Like, he's this Hall of Fame player after his prime. Like he was dealt to this quagmire franchise ostensibly to be the Crash Davis, right? Like, teach the young guys how to play a professional season, maybe get to the playoffs.
Yes, dispense some life wisdoms and lessons from a career spent bouncing around.
Right. And then, like, what does he do? He resuscitates his career, plays out of his mind. He makes all NBA second team and is now playing some of the best basketball of his life since coming back from freaking COVID protocol.
Well, Kevin, it's the COVID protocol. It's the fact that he had that shoulder injury. We just learned, like, last week he has torn ligaments in his hand. You know, and we all know, if you follow the NBA at all, that this was the guy who had the single worst contract allegedly in the NBA. And here he is damaged bodily. And he does 73 points over his last two games, 17 assists, two turnovers on 65% shooting, and 73% from three.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. And you start rooting for the old guys at a certain point in your life. I'm at that point in my life, and so it's gratifying.
Yeah, ever since I realized that I'm basically the same age as Chris Paul, my whole vantage point in this has changed, Kevin. But I'm thinking about something Monty Williams said, the coach of the Suns, during the game. He said he basically just tries to stay out of Chris Paul's way at this point. Is it that simple for Phoenix?
I think it is. It's game management. It's not sexy, right? You and I got on, and I think we talked about Damian Lillard, these pyrotechnics. They're these guys in the league in this era who just light it up, right? It's management. It's tactical. It's surgical. Coach on the floor is always this cliche, but insofar as a coach's job is to organize, to remind people sort of the physical cues required to get a good basketball possession. There's nobody better than that. And when you have a guy like Chris Paul, like Monty Williams is the smartest guy in the building, right? Because he's not going to overcoach. He's going to delegate.
Yes, and when Chris Paul delegates, and this is where I want to bring in like the other human beings on this team, when he delegates to those guys, I mean, what they're playing is the style of basketball, Kevin, and you've been ahead of this too all season. It is a beautiful thing to watch. It is symphonic, not just because of the conductor, but because of the other instruments that he has arrayed in front of him.
Right, it's a really complete orchestra, I mean, to extend the metaphor, right? Like if you think about what do you want a modern starting five to have. You want like that manager, that organizer, who by the way can step back and hit a three, and then you want the dynamic wing, the isolation score, can, you know, get it with both hands, can back out a sitter and just destroy him. You want the 3-and-D guy, right? Mikal Bridges, that 3-4 tweener who's really big and can guard and is nasty. And then you got the center who's just a rim runner, right? And they have this oddly complete set, and it just works.
The idea that Chris Paul, in all of his, and you know, we can call him personality quirks, other people would label it far more bluntly and just say his jerkish tendencies. The fact that this seems to be a team in concert, in harmony, to keep torturing this metaphor, Kevin, why is it working so much better here with Phoenix, better than it has at his previous stops throughout the league?
I mean, I think your contemporaries in life don't want to be mentored by you, right? Like, you know, what your age cohort might find really bossy, like, who is that guy? You know who doesn't mind that? Guys who grew up watching you and yes, are like, you know, 14 years younger. Like, is it possible this was always his function, was to be on a team the last 6 or 7 years where, you know, like the Orlando Magic, you know, these young teams that just keep cycling through the young guys and never really had a catalyst? Maybe that was always it. It wasn't that there was anything wrong with Chris Paul. It's just, you know, again, your contemporaries don't always want to be managed and told what to do, right? But you will take it from a mentor. You will take it from somebody who has been where you want to go, not necessarily the finals, but has had the career you imagine yourself having.
When I talk about Chris Paul, I want to be mindful of all the cliches we may be indulging, but there is something to the psychology you just described where young Chris Paul, that is a bossy know-it-all, but old Chris Paul, that dude is a sagacious, wise elder.
Right. I mean, he acts like the smartest guy in the room. And now he really is the smartest guy in the room, right? Like, nobody minds that, you know, if it's a simple fact. People mellow as they get older. You know, he's been to OKC and back. He was dealt away, you know, from Houston. I think, like, there's a certain piece you come to in sort of early middle age. And I think that's it. I suspect he's a mellower guy, too. Just pairing him with a young core that is so desperate, especially like Phoenix, right? They were the gang that couldn't shoot straight. You know, we were already hearing, well, when Devin Booker is going to go to the Knicks. You know, that was the conversation. And so this particular core, which had a ton of talent, but just didn't have that catalyst, it's almost like you look retrospect, of course this is the team he was meant for.
You mentioned a Chris Paul who is contemplating his own mortality, and maybe that mellows him. I am curious about what the Milwaukee Bucks are thinking, what Giannis was thinking in terms of his physical mortality on a night like tonight, because I didn't think this guy was going to play, Kevin. And in the first half, he looked excellent.
Got a good ball, nice turnaround jumper. And obviously, it's only the first couple of minutes, but he looks like he has a nice spring to the step.
Had that unbelievable chase down LeBronian block.
Paul deflects it. Crowder to Bridges. Bridges up inside. Blocked by Antetokounmpo. What a recovery.
But as the game wore on, he got seemingly tired and or just sort of fell back to earth in the way that someone who is injured might. Finishing with only 20 points, only 17 rebounds. What did you see when you were watching Giannis?
It's pretty amazing because I was talking to someone who's close to Giannis about 3 or 4 days ago. And I was like, he's not going to play, right? Like, you buy a couple of days in Phoenix. They have 3 days off before Milwaukee. You get, you know, sort of a full 10 days of recovery. And this person's like, look, don't be surprised. He's just, like, it's a body that heals. It's kind of, you know, he's been called the Greek freak, but one of his superpowers is the guy heals incredibly quickly. And there he is. And there he is, springy. I mean, we saw it in the first 4 minutes. I mean, he's still clearly limited. And I think, you know, the aerobic factor tonight was clearly an issue. You know, they say, hey, if you even go 48 hours without sort of exercise, you lose a little capacity. He was slightly reluctant. And then the margin between full throttle Giannis and even 90% Giannis, you know, is a margin. And I think you probably saw it late in the game, but it's incredible. And also, it's just so great. I don't want to watch a finals where, like, the best guys aren't on the floor. I mean, this is what we wait all year for. And I'm kind of happy for the Bucks. I know they lost tonight, but I do think it colors the rest of this series completely differently.
Yeah, yeah. So what is on the line right now, Kevin, for Chris Paul's Phoenix Suns? I just want to get the big picture here because there's so much conversation around, and again, this is, if you're to make a word cloud of, I feel like, all of the conversations written, podcasted, televised, and otherwise around this Suns team and Chris Paul, the word in 160-point font is legacy. And I'm just curious, when you watch this series, do you see it through that lens? How do you enjoy what we're about to get here?
I think it's a question of sort of a new transition. And I think Adam Silver talked a little bit about this, but this league has been subsisting on LeBron, Steph Curry, before them, Kobe. You're talking about just a cadre of superstars that's about to retire, and they need new blood. And there's always this fear, you know, a smaller market, can that sustain somebody, a true superstar? Can they have kind of worldwide appeal? Can they transcend the sport? And what's really cool is this is a finals of the next generation. Like, Chris Paul is the great story, right? He won't be on the Suns finals team in 4 years, likely. I mean, I think it's fair to say that as this young core hits its prime, they will speak fondly of the Chris Paul era, what got it started, right? Mm. And that's what this final is. It's a chance to sort of regenerate the pool of stars. I mean, Giannis, Devin Booker. These are two interesting franchises. I mean, Phoenix, what is on the line? I mean, Pablo, 2 years ago, I was writing features about, I mean, this is one of the woebegone franchises in sports. What a mess, right?
Yes.
Like, they were there are always a couple of just what I call pigpen franchises, right? Like, there's just this dust around them as they walk through the league. And they were that team.
Absolutely.
Like, they've even surpassed the Sacramento Kings. And I don't recall a turnaround like this. I don't just mean, oh, they won not so many games and they started winning games. I mean in terms of the entire spirit of a franchise. It's unheard of to do it this quickly. And what's on the line? Going from being a laughingstock to a team that can potentially be playing in late spring for the foreseeable future.
All right, Kevin, after the break, I want to get into how the Suns evolved into this version of themselves and how the Milwaukee Bucks can avoid a potential lingering stench.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
So, Kevin, one of the other characters in this series, whose name I'm embarrassed to admit I'm only saying now at the start of this second segment, is DeAndre Ayton. Because that dude, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, I believe no one has had a more accurate postseason than that guy. He's shooting now above 71% from the field, minimum 150 attempts or something like that. And that guy, paired with this offense, I just don't know how the Bucks adjust to match up with what the Suns have going.
It's really interesting. And there's this game of sliding doors, because what's so fun about it is DeAndre Ayton was the guy they drafted instead of Luka Doncic for like the first 3 years of his life. You know, on balance, in a vacuum, you might still want Doncic. I mean, I think that's a fair thing. And that's no knock on DeAndre Ayton. But like, if you drafted Doncic, you wouldn't go out and get Chris Paul, and then you don't assemble this particular team at a particular moment with this particular personnel. And DeAndre Ayton got the world's greatest tour guide to being a big man, right? It's Chris Paul. And I know, here we go. He always comes back to Chris Paul. But what Ayton's learned how to do, sort of the dark arts of being a big man, you know, knowing the timing of the role, like just attacking the rim at the optimal moment. He's learned how to be an adequate defender. He is a paragon of efficiency.
He's in the tradition of, you know, DeAndre Jordan, Tyson Chandler, guys who can destroy rims and are elevated as a result of being around Chris Paul. But there is something else going on in their dynamic, right? I mean, you have this piece on ESPN.com, Kevin, with Kevin Pelton about the pick and roll. And that was something we saw again and again and again in this orchestra we've now described at length. When you're the Milwaukee Bucks, I want to take this from the position of Mike Budenholzer, their coach. When they are humming like that, and that pick and roll is shredding your defense, what do you do? How do you adjust to that going forward?
Yeah, there's so much interesting backstory here, right? Like, so last season, the Bucks maintained their very successful drop pick and roll defense. And that's when the big man remains in the paint. You kind of see him sort of backpedaling, kind of guarding the paint. And by the way, the Milwaukee Bucks had the top defense each of the previous 2 years. So it's not like this didn't work. It worked masterfully. And so they go into the postseason and everybody's just, this doesn't work in the playoffs. Why don't you adjust? And their, you know, assumption is we don't adjust because we have the best defense in the league. But they just got pummeled. And so they come out in game one and what are they doing? They're listening, right? They're switching all the screens. And guess what? They're getting killed. Like, they can't win no matter what. It's because Chris Paul plus DeAndre Ayton, or you can put Devin Booker in there as well. Like, it is almost indefensible. So you get into this situation where poor Brook Lopez, like Pablo, the guy scores 17 points in 23 minutes. He's hitting from the perimeter. He's controlling things down low. He's a really good defender. He's a really good rim protector. But there's one thing he's not excellent at. I mean, he's actually reasonably good for a seven-footer defending the pick and roll. But he's just getting killed because Chris Paul knows how to use whatever it is you're going to give him.
Oh, Kevin, it's like that scene in The Empire Strikes Back where, like, the snow speeders of the Phoenix Suns are just running around and tripping up the giant AT-AT walker that is Brook Lopez. I'm sorry, Brook. You're an excellent player relative to most common conventional wisdom. But my Lord, were you useless trying to defend those small guys.
Right, and it's a real dilemma for Milwaukee. I mean, they did, at the end of the game, and they staged their comeback, Pablo, they went small, right? They took Lopez off the floor. They made Giannis Antetokounmpo their center, and it worked, right? Because now everybody's fast. Everybody's capable of guarding the perimeter, and it's a much more effective scheme. You know, you lose a little bit. You lose some rebounding, though that's not Lopez's specialty. You lose some rim protection. He's a really useful guy. You know, you can manufacture a basket down low. But this is going to be the great torment for the Milwaukee Bucks. They don't have a lot of depth now with Dante DiVincenzo out. And so this is going to be the big theme strategically, I think, in this series, is what do you do against the best pick and roll practitioner this league has seen, and with right now the best finishing big man in the league.
Yeah, because when Chris Paul is running the pick and roll, Kevin, it's, I just want to be clear about what makes him such a sorcerer at that particular dynamic, because it's not just that he is sort of running you into the ground, doing the same thing over and over again. He has options, right? I mean, he has the ability to make choices at a speed that is faster seemingly than what the Bucks are really prepared for.
Yeah, it's vision. Right. And it was a brilliant moment in the second half where the Bucks said, OK, enough of this switching. We're getting killed. Let's just go back to doing what we do really well, which is fighting over screens. We're a strong team. These are really good defenders, the Milwaukee Bucks. And what does Chris Paul do on the very first possession where they adjust their offense. He uses, because they now go back to the drop, he uses all that space in front of Lopez, now that he's dropping, yep, to float a lob up for DeAndre Ayton.
Ball on the right side against Tucker. Free throw line into the lane. Floats it for Ayton, who jams it home.
Chris Paul now attacking Lopez not to score it. He knew Ayton, a vertical threat against a smaller defender.
Like, it's a game of whack-a-mole. Like, you switch to this strategy, oh, he'll figure out where you're vulnerable. But you go to that strategy. They even tried trapping, you know, the pick and roll. And, like, what happened? You know, the ball went to Ayton. He got fouled, went to the line, right? They have a choice between some bad options. There is no good option against this pick and roll.
Yeah, and look, it's a conductor of an orchestra. It's Tom Brady under center. It is any number of figures of speech for someone who is just in total control. And I wonder, in the Bucks locker room after this game, Kevin, when the eyes are looking around the room and they're saying, okay, Giannis, we hope you're healthy, but heroic attempt to be yourself tonight. But then there's Drew Holiday and Chris Middleton, the other two members of this big three. And Chris Middleton, 29 points on 12 for 26 shooting. Drew Holiday, just 10 points on 4 for 14 shooting. What is there for them to do or adjust to in this series to make this a competitive one?
Holiday's interesting because when Giannis was out, he got many more traditionally kind of conventional point guard opportunities, right? We saw the ball in his hands, initiating offense, pick and roll, or getting a matchup he liked in isolation, and it worked, right? It's not the most creative or elegant offense, but you started to see, oh, wow, Holiday got to be a little bit of himself. And they're going to have to find more situations like that, even with Giannis in the game. He's a guy who, when endowed with the responsibility of being a point guard, tends to perform very well. But I think in this particular offense, they need to let him kind of run some offense. It was fun watching sort of the Middleton-Holiday tandem when Giannis was out, and they kind of in some ways just have to get some of that offense and piece it into Giannis on the floor.
I know you're not a predictions guy. I'm not going to make you do that. But should there be hope for Milwaukee fans, for Bucks faithful, people who are watching this game thinking, we've come so far and we haven't had very much. Please give us something.
Oh, I think they're things small and big. I mean, first of all, the Bucks are typically one of the best teams in the league at defending without fouling. And they fouled a ton in game one. You clean that up. They're also one of the better transition D teams. So get back on defense on the break. That's good for a couple of points, right? And then more largely, you know, if Antetokounmpo gets healthier, Chris Middleton did not get to the line once, right? Mm. Drew Holiday, ugh, there's a lot of ground that can be made up with some effort, but not a ton of effort. This is a good basketball team. This is not going to be a sweep. There's a prediction, Pablo Torre. There is not going to be a sweep. It's a good team. And I think there's plenty of hope for Milwaukee Bucks fans.
And as for the rest of us, Kevin, the people who aren't like rooting for a particular team in this series, but the people out there who are thinking to themselves, Suns, Bucks, I mean, really, NBA, this is how this ends. What do you say to those people?
What I would say is Chris Paul is a national treasure. Giannis Antetokounmpo is a physical marvel. Devin Booker is charisma on a basketball court. Like, this is fun. Chris Middleton's a, you know what Cade Cunningham, the number one pick likely in the NBA draft, says? He designs his game around Chris Middleton's game. So everybody, learn to stop worrying and enjoy the mid-markets. This is fun. This is a great matchup. And we just need a full-strength Giannis Antetokounmpo, and we're going to be there.
Kevin Arnovitz, the patron saint of the NBA small markets. Thanks for staying up late with us, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right, up next. The most dramatic finish in the Euros unfolded last night in London. So we called up someone who was there.
Delicious, meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each one-ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
Sam Borden is our global sports correspondent here at ESPN, which means that he has been eating his way through Europe, basically, and the Euro 2020 tournament. And yes, I know it's 2021, but these are the weird things that happen when you cover a global sports tournament that might be as important as the World Cup. But Sam, my jealousy, I think, peaked today. I wanted to be you. I wanted to live your life more than I have at any other moment in this last month because, well, where were you earlier today?
Yeah, most of the night I was at a very loud Wembley Stadium, and it was great. I have to say, you know, there have been reduced capacities because of the pandemic, obviously, throughout this Euros tournament. Tonight it was the biggest British crowd since the pandemic began, 60,000 fans at Wembley for Italy and Spain. And it was one of those games where it wasn't the final, but it felt like the final. I mean, the way the teams played, the goals that were scored, just the stakes and the emotion in the evening. I've covered, I've been lucky to cover a bunch of finals and big tournaments in the past, and this had every bit the kind of feel that those games did.
Yeah, we're talking about a 1-1 semifinal match that ended in penalty kicks, Sam. And penalties are this thing that are both like the joy and the scourge of this sport. It is a thing that I think so many people love because it's just the most dramatic theater. And on the other hand, it's kind of like a weird way to end a game where you just exhausted yourself by running up and down a field. Here you are trying to basically hit a target. And the scene that unfolded with Jorginho winning this thing for Italy.
This for the final. Oh! Cheeky! Impudent! Decisive! Forza Italia! Italy are in the Euro 2020 final!
It was ridiculous. I mean, like, what he does, that little hop, which is his signature, and then the goalkeeper falling to his knee.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it's like, it was like, you know, a movie script. You know, I remember, Pablo, we talked about this like before the opening game, right? And we were saying Italy, there's just something about them. Like, I don't know, they have this feel and they've had that feel all the way through. They haven't lost. And I think whoever they face in the final on Sunday, they're going to be the favorite. If the same situation happens with England, I think the volume is going to go into another stratosphere.
Well, let's get to that other game because we are also on the precipice of England playing Denmark. And this is happening, of course, in England. And the psychology of the English football fan, Sam, is such a particular animal. How are these people feeling right now on the brink of this final?
Nervous, I would say, Pablo. I mean, like, because you just said it, I mean, this is a situation that almost surely will never happen again for the vast majority of these players. I mean, Harry Kane admitted it. He said that he talked about it with the other players on England's team. Like, to have a chance to get to a final at Wembley as an English national team player, like, these opportunities just don't come along. And, you know, beyond the fact that there have been plenty of moments during this tournament where England hasn't looked its best, now you kind of throw into the mix that they're also going up against Denmark, who, despite the fact that they lost their best player in, you know, unbelievable fashion when Christian Eriksen collapsed just before halftime in the first game, put all that aside, it seems like Denmark is almost like the team of the tournament, right? Like a team of destiny. It sure feels like, to a lot of people, Denmark has something magical going, and there is no reason to believe that that's not going to continue, even if they're playing in Wembley against England.
the team that likes to think of itself as the cradle of the sport itself. And when we say this phrase that's now a meme, Sam, that, you know, it's coming home. Like, explain for the listener what that even is and what's sort of wound up in all of that, because I know that this is both a little bit of tongue-in-cheek and a lot of bit of genuine longing.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt about it. I mean, the short version is that it's a song that, you know, came, that it's a song that was created for the 1996 Euro tournament, and the English fans have just sort of adopted it. And, the, you know, the mantra of it's coming home, football's coming home. Like, as you said, football was invented in the United Kingdom. And so the idea that a championship would be coming back to the place where the sport was created. But then there's also this feeling of like, man, as an English soccer fan, we've seen failure in so many different ways, in so many different fashions, that wouldn't it be just perfect if England had all of these games in their home field, had all of this opportunity to get to the biggest moment in Wembley Stadium, had the draw fall in the best possible way for them. Like, you know, the knockout rounds couldn't have lined up any better, and they're going to end up losing to Denmark. Like, that, I think, is sort of like the quintessential cynical English fans' perspective is like, yeah, like, sure, it all seems perfect, which means it almost surely won't end perfectly. Denmark is a team that comes out and plays. I mean, they scored in the first 2 minutes of the game against Belgium. Belgium, the best team in the world. So this is a team, Denmark, that comes out and likes to go right after it. And so I think if you're an English fan, and certainly the fans that I've spoken to, the fear is that, like, they're going to come out, they're going to play hard, and Denmark is going to sort of pierce that shield early, as they've done several times during this tournament already. And if that happens, panic is going to set in.
And so if you're Italy, Sam, who are you hoping to see in this final?
You know, that's a great question, Pablo. I guess if I'm Italy, I would probably rather play Denmark. I think that, you know, the lack of experience and certainly the lack of the home crowd is something that you'd be, you know, happier to face. But I honestly think that if I'm Italy, I'm also looking at it as like, look, I haven't lost in like 30 some games. I've played on the road at Wembley. I played at home in Rome. Like, they've pretty much handled whatever's come their way.
And I just want to point this out, Sam, for those who maybe missed it, I did decide to back Italy in this tournament entirely because I was sort of dreaming and fantasizing about you eating gnocchi on my behalf. As this trip winds to a close, tell me what the greatest thing you've eaten is.
It's easy for me to say that there are no meals that I had in Scotland, in Glasgow, that are even in the discussion. So that was by far the most difficult place.
The haggis wasn't doing it for you?
It did not do it. No, it did not do it for us. But I will say we had a great meal in Copenhagen. We had, you know, like a nice mix of seafood and fish, but also some Danish meat, which was terrific. Honestly, it's hard to beat that gnocchi. I have to say, I'm not sure that it ever gets better than Italians doing pasta.
Sam Borden, we'll check back in with you. But until then, please keep eating on our behalf.
I appreciate it, Pablo. I certainly will.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.